You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yep, you're good.
Okay, this one, golly. Well, welcome to another fantastic episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron along with Susan Giddings, and today we're going to cover some great topics, one of them being the 821 Amendment and several other things. Don't want to spoiler alert, but we got some good stuff. Real quick, before we go too much further, I'll be putting up some more links to our YouTube channel on the Facebook group. We've had a little bit of a cosmetic upgrade on the YouTube channel. So now we have thumbnails. Our graphic artist, Kimberly, awesome. I partnered with her to get some new thumbnails, and it just makes all the difference in the world. You know what I mean? We went from like amateurs to professionals overnight. So it looks really,
well,
really good.
I also like that we don't have those camera free shots, because invariably, like, you got
those
looks. Yeah. One of us isn't looking right.
One of us is jammed up. I've tried. Actually, there'd be like 50 thumbnails, Susan. I just try to pick the least shittiest one. Yeah. And it was a hard task.
Yeah.
So anyway, so we have that. Of course, we have LA Talk Radio on the bottom of it because we represent the mothership here. Thank you, Sam, and LA Talk Radio for being just so good to us, man. Just let us do whatever we want. That's the way it should be, damn it. No, he lets us do it. He lets us do whatever we want. He's such a great guy, and glad to do that. All right, so without further ado, I know you were prepping, and
I have been.
Oh my gosh!
Homework. You know me. Right. The queen of geek. So
let's hear it.
So, couple of things. First off, we were just talking before we went on the air. Our Facebook group blew past 18,000 followers,
yay,
just in the last 2 weeks. 18,200. Thanks so much, everyone. We're doing something right as we're bringing new members on, and hopefully we're helping people. And the other thing that we missed was Around the Block is 1 year old. Our anniversary was March of last year, last month. Yeah. So we started March of 25. We've been on the air with y'all for 13 months now.
Yeah.
Okay. Enough of that.
Yes.
All right. So the 821 Amendment, Bruce and I are both members of NACDL. That's the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And we kind of stay up on what's going on. And in the March, April issue, there was a column talking about the 821 Amendment. And we haven't talked about that in a while because it's a little bit older now, not much, but it's a little older. But the point the author was making, the attorney writing the column, was talking about the impact with FSA. So for those of you maybe less familiar with 821, or maybe you've had an 821 and you filed it or you're working on it, whatever the case is, the 821 amendment was a sentencing guideline change that allowed individuals, and I'm not going to go into the details on it, but you could get rid of one or two criminal history points. Now, sometimes that change resulted in a sentence reduction because the person went from one range down to the next range, right? Their criminal history, they were on the cusp, it made a category change for them, right? In other cases, it didn't. It didn't result in a sentencing reduction, but they still lost a criminal history point or two. Now, why is that important? Because in both custody classification and FSA, criminal history points are the most heavily weighted item in the entire instrument. And if you are at a cut point, if you're at an edge where you could move from one category to another category, not sentencing guideline categories, bureau categories, right? If you are right on the cusp, that one or two points can make a huge difference in your custody classification or in your pattern risk level. Now, that seems easy enough. What's the problem? The problem is, unless the courts or probation advised the Bureau what the change was, what was the basis for a sentence reduction, or if there was no sentence reduction, what changed. The Bureau is not going to make any presumptions about why an individual's sentence changed or didn't change. They have to receive documentation. As I shared on the NACDL message board, highlighting the column, the Bureau considers the PSR, the pre-sentence investigation report, to be gospel. Gospel, handed down from the hand of God. It is gospel. And unless they receive something from the courts, an addendum to a PSR, an amended PSR, a court order that says the criminal history points have now been amended per Amendment 821 from 6 to 5, right? Or probation advises them. Unless somebody from courts or probation advise the Bureau, they are not going to make a change. So if you are sitting out there and your family member got an 821 amendment reduction, they need to be following up with their unit team particularly. Now, if they're earning their time credits, they're in minimum security, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. But if they're sitting in any security level above a low, if they're not earning time credits yet because they're medium risk level, they need to be checking on that. And that documentation needs to come from the courts or probation. So wanted to share that. Very important. But one other aside, and this was something I also shared with the attorneys. Anytime an individual receives a sentence reduction because some element in their offense was thrown out or was amended, if you were originally held accountable for 500 grams of cocaine and now you're only being held accountable for 100 grams, right? The Bureau receives an amended order that just says your sentence was changed from this to this. That's it. They're not necessarily getting information about what changed. Did the dollar amount change in a fraud case? Did the amount of drugs change in a drug case? Did some history item get thrown out? I had a case many, many years ago, and by many, I literally mean the 90s, many years ago, where an individual was prosecuted. This was early, like I said, it was early in the 90s. And so he actually had two different judgments. He had one judgment, but one count was prosecuted under the old law. And the second count was prosecuted under the new law because his fraud case transpired over the dateline, right? He was given two sentences. So he had two judgments. One was the old law judgment. One was the new law judgment. They were run consecutive because, of course, you can't put those together. He appealed his case. By the time he actually won his appeal, the old law case was done. So by the time he got far enough along to put everything together, the old law case, he had been paroled on the old law case, which meant the new law case started immediately. But the courts in his appeal, and it took a while, which is why the one case was already resolved. But in his case, the court specifically said they threw out two paragraphs of his pre-sentence investigation report. Why were these two paragraphs important in terms of the old law sentence that was already done? Those two paragraphs were specifically regarding the amount of monetary loss. When the court threw those out as invalid, that meant when the commission a year and a half earlier gave him a parole date based on a dollar amount that was no longer in the PSR. Fortunately, I understood the impact of that. I was a young case manager, but I still understood the impact that the PSR, the commission used to grant him parole, now had two paragraphs that no longer exist. So it took a while of talking and cajoling them to listen to what I was saying, but they went back and they issued a nunk-pro-tunk parole notification, a notice of action, to advance his parole date. he couldn't appeal the old case because the old case was done. But by appealing the new law case, getting that sentence reduced, and then going back to the commission and say, hey, commission, these two paragraphs no longer exist. He gets his parole date retroactively advanced, which means he then started his sentence earlier. That's the only reason we had that was because we actually had the full appeal, not just the order. So we had the documentation. That doesn't always happen. I mean the Bureau as a case manager. I had the full court's decision, not just a judgment. So always, always important. Get that documentation to the Bureau. It may or may not make a difference, but don't presume the Bureau understands that your case manager understands that this dollar amount was changed or whatever the basis was, because realistically, they may only have an amended order. So that's that. On to new stuff. So I wanted to do that first so we'd have plenty of time for the news.
Yeah, get that out of the way. Sure.
Yes. Okay, so there was a recent 11th Circuit Court of Appeals decision. Actually, there were two. One was dated from February of this year, and the second one was dated in April of this year. And I will say the second one was remanded back, not with any decision, but basically was remanded back to the district court to say, hey, take a look at that ruling we did in February and use the standard we established. Okay, so compassionate release. You guys have heard us talk about, we've had clients call or, you know, not clients, they weren't clients, they were just individual questions. The Bureau has always been very tight and the courts have been very tight on this caregiver status. When something is going on and the individual in custody requests compassionate release because they are the only available caregiver for an immediate family, for a family member. Now, initially, this only applied to a individual with a minor child. And I've got the policy and this stuff because the Sentencing Commission has updated the amendments. The Bureau policy, as we all know, takes time. Although they're getting better at publishing policy, it takes time to update. So currently in Bureau policy, and this case, just so everyone understands, this was a sentencing guideline case, not a Bureau case, but it's really important on the Bureau side. So Bureau Programs Policy Statement on Compassionate Release 5050.50 only addresses the incapacitation of the family of the caregiver of a minor child of the inmates and addresses incapacitation of the caregiver's spouse or partner. That's because that's all that was in the guidelines. When in December of 23, the Sentencing Commission expanded their guidelines to include immediate family members. So in a situation, if the inmate is the only available caregiver for a family member, that something has happened. This isn't something that was known at the time of sentencing because the judge could have taken that into account. This is something that comes up, a new incident. Maybe the person had a caregiver and something happened to that caregiver. Maybe in the case of, you know, a parent, they've had a stroke, they've had a heart attack. Something is going on. Excuse me. Let me get a drink here. Mm-hmm. Something has happened since sentencing. Something's happened since sentencing to have the inmate say, hey, I need to come home to take care of this family member. Okay. That's what compassionate release is. The expansion by the guidelines extended it from just minor children and adults to immediate family members. So we're all on the same page. So then comes along Mr. Robolo Gallo. He goes through the administrative remedy process. His father is incapacitated, and he says he is the only individual that can provide caregiving for him. He goes through the process. He goes to the district court, and the district court denies him first time. But the district court says, hey, we're going to allow you to refile. You need to be more specific, right? He failed to establish that he was the only available caregiver. So they said, go back. You can come back and you can resubmit. So he does that. And when he does that, he provides them some information and they deny him again. He appeals to the 11th Circuit. That's where we are up to February. So I'm just going to share some things from the circuit court's decision directly. Bruce, you look like you have a question.
Yeah, I do. Thanks. Good read, by the way. And I could just be pulling this out of my nostril. Was there like a ordinarily comma type thing that you had to be the only family member or within five? If you had another family member within 500 miles?
No. So the law. So good question. Yeah. So let's start with the law. All the law says is under modifications, this is 18 U.S.C. 3582, subparagraphs C1A, Roman numeral 1, extraordinary or compelling reasons that warrant such a reduction. That's a reason why. The Bureau articulates, goes out and has rules, and the sentencing guidelines provide their guidance so that, and they're providing the guidance to the court. The rules in the case of compassionate release, the Bureau and the commission kind of worked together. The Bureau has their process, but it's the sentencing guidelines are giving direction to the court about what the court should consider. So this particular policy, which doesn't address immediate family members, there's some other things it doesn't address that the commission has added in their amending process that the Bureau is working through. So an individual requesting a compassionate release via the Bureau regarding an immediate family member can do it. It's just the policy is behind, right, which is, of course, not a surprise. So in terms of the standards that the guidelines have spread out, that the commission spread out, the death or incapacitation of the caregiver of the defendant's minor children, right? Or for a dependent child who is 18 years or older and incapable of self-care because of mental or physical disability or medical condition. So your adult child is in their 30s.
Okay.
They themselves are not independent. Right. They still require a caregiver, and then something happens to their caregiver. So that's the first issue. That's with the child. The second, that's paragraph A. Paragraph B, the incapacitation of the defendant's spouse or registered partner when the defendant would be the only available caregiver for the spouse or registered partner. So the sentencing guidelines language is only available caregiver. So paragraph C, which was the basis of this court decision, was the incapacitation of the defendant's parent when the defendant would be the only available caregiver. And then they go on to say the defendant established circumstances similar to those listed in paragraphs 3A and through 3C involving other immediate family members or an individual whose relationship with the defendant is similar in kind to that of an immediate family member. We're talking about siblings. We could be talking about step siblings, half siblings, still immediate family members. You know, we always look at immediate family members as parents, spouse, sibling, children, right?
Right, but those other relationships,
a aunt that raised someone is an aunt is an immediate family member. But if you were raised by your aunt,
she's your like your aunt mom,
functioned
yeah.
as mom. That was right. your de facto immediate family member. So that's where that falls in. Okay. So in the case of Mr. Robello Gallo, he went back to the court, to the district court, and said, listen, this is why I'm the only available. And I'm going to just pull this right from the order or the opinion.
Transcript. Yeah.
Right. He asserted that one child was deceased. One's whereabouts were unknown. Two lived in the United States. He is from Honduras. I believe it was Honduras. And his father is also still in Honduras. One could not relocate to Honduras. And the remaining child lived in Honduras, but was 4 hours away. So no one was immediately in the area of where the father lived in Honduras. The inmate is a Honduran citizen, so he can go to Honduras, right? So he's trying to be released.
He's also a U.S. citizen?
You know what? I don't know offhand, but at this point, it's actually not relevant to the conversation. The point, I'm just, I believe he was, but I don't want to lie to you.
Right. Money.
Because the issue becomes, it's not a matter, and the court, it's really interesting as they go through this. It's about the other individuals. It's not actually about the inmate. The inmate has to show that he's the only one left. He has to explain why the others in that circle of family members are unable to. Why is he the only one? So, and he goes on to explain that this one son that's 4 hours away, he can't travel back and forth because he doesn't have a car. He can't accommodate his grandfather in his own home because of space, and he can't relocate to the grandfather's home because he would not be able to find work and provide for his children. So those are, so he tries to hit everything, right? Okay. The court ruled, the district court ruled that because the son was within hours of the incapacitated family member, the inmate was not the only one available. And he said, a finding of compassionate release cannot rest solely on avoiding the inconvenience for a convicted inmate's family. That was the district court's decision. So the appellate court comes in and says, he appeals to the appellate court, and they say they have to determine two things. First is, what is the definition? What does it mean to be the only available caregiver? And once they determine what that means, they have to determine if then the district court made an error, right? Is the record sufficient to say that the district court considered the factors relevant to defining only available caregiver? So now here's the geekiness in me, right? This was a case of what they call a question of first impression. That means this hasn't been touched. What does only available caregiver? No court has tackled this subject. This is the first one. So it's very exciting. There's no Supreme Court decisions, no other circuit court decisions. There's no other district court decision where they tried to define it. This is actually really interesting.
Right.
For the geek in me. Okay. So they start out with both parties, inmate and government, agree that he has to establish that he's the only caregiver and not just another caregiver, right? He has to be the only one. Now, he argues that the court really has to look at this on a case-by-case basis and looking at what he describes as the practical realities of providing care, right? Are there other people that can do it? He contends the focus should be on an alternative caregiver's capacity to provide care and willingness to do so. So can they do it and will they do it, right? Now, the government, their initial argument that they came back with probably was the wrong argument to start with. And they argued that any potential caregiver who is not incapacitated themselves can be a caregiver. So as long as you're also not incapacitated, well, then you can be a caregiver.
Right.
The court didn't appreciate that response. The government's argument in this case was, well, look, it talks about if the for their minor child if the other parent, right, is incapacitated, that's right, and can't take care of their child, that's grounds right for the inmate to step in.
Yes.
So they said, so clearly that's the standard for available caregiver, is they're not otherwise incapacitated. The court didn't agree with that. In fact, they described the government's interpretation would lead to, quote, absurd results, requiring the inmate to be the only non-incapacitated person who could right theoretically provide care. So, that was pretty harsh.
So
go ahead.
Yeah, look, sounds like there are a couple things I'll say just too. One, they're leaning really hard on just one prong of, are you the only person that can do this? But let me tell you, folks, I think this is a huge ray of sunshine, because you and I both know, and you and I encountered many inmates during our respective careers that were the only child, right? And their parent was older, and the parent might have siblings, but they're dead. And that's a wrap. You know what I mean? It's this kid's alive.
They literally, yeah. In the past, it was, you literally had to show you were like the only person on the planet. Yeah. And it was very, like, if there was anybody who could, then you're not the only available caregiver. And so this is really kind of interesting. Like I said, it's not a case against the Bureau. It was
right
regarding the guidelines, but still, you know, even if a case makes it through the Bureau, ultimately compassionate release is decided at the court level. It's not the Bureau's decision. The Bureau is only recommending a case put forward. Right.
Right.
So,
and in the questions that we get, sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
But there's not much in my tank here. We get a lot of cases about, hey, my child is on the autism spectrum, or hey, my child has special needs or whatever. And it's documented in the PSR. However, I think what really sinks their battleship is that there's other people. There's other people taking this child for services now, or there's other people taking this child to the doctor now. There's other people around, and therefore they got nothing coming.
Well, and the court did distinguish. I think there's more argument with this, and we'll go into what the court says you got to think about. I think there's a stronger argument. You know, it's one thing when it's the minor child and mom is, mom's incapacitated. And we're looking at foster care. But it also goes far enough to say it doesn't have to go all the way to that. There are right reasons that other family members sure might not be able to do so. So I do think this is extremely positive. And
it's a step
even
in the right
though,
direction for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And when we get to the I'm watching my time, when we, because I don't want to lose this. When we get to the five factors, I think you're going to recognize that. So the government did back off of their original idea that somehow they had to be the only one on the planet. So it came down to that when an individual has to demonstrate only available caregiver, an inmate must establish that there's no other likely caregiver who is both qualified and free to provide care.
That opens up the windows.
That opens that language
all
of
day.
No other caregiver that is likely to provide, be both qualified and free to provide care, and free to provide care. An alternative caregiver is qualified if he has the capacity to provide an incapacitated person with care that the person needs. An alternative caregiver is free in material constraints if material constraints prevent him from providing, if no material, I'm sorry, let me read that again. An alternative caregiver is free if no material constraints prevent them from providing care. Whether an alternative caregiver is both qualified and free is a fact question that necessarily turns on the circumstances of the particular case. So the court came back and said, yes, this is a case-by-case thing. The district courts need to dig into the facts before a ruling is made. So,
quick question.
Yes.
Thank you. Is this something that the inmate can just file a motion to the court? It does. There's no administrative remedy. You can completely right to the court.
Yeah. So the way things are written right now is the individual needs to exhaust administrative remedy. And then there's an or that talks about the 30-day lapse in the warden's response. And I know I had some disagreements with some, and when we had a conversation going on NACDL about what that means. And
why put the Bureau in the middle on it? But this was framed as this, hey, everybody, this is something between the courts and the situation. And then all of a sudden the Bureau is in the middle of it again. Go ahead. Yep.
So first off is you go through administrative remedy, you exhaust administrative remedy 9, 10, 11, and then you file to the court. That's true anytime you file any kind of action to the court against the Bureau, right? When an individual is filing an administrative remedy, they are saying, I meet the criteria and the Bureau is blocking my paperwork for a reason that's not consistent with policy of the law. Now, because the Bureau had some issues in the past with timely processing compassionate releases, the Sentencing Commission had some issue with that. But more importantly, in the First Step Act, they amended that language and they put in an or clause. And the or clause was talking about the lapsing of the warden's decision, right? You submit the cop-out to the warden to request a compassionate release. There is a process, a review process, where the institution says, yes, we're going to recommend you up, meaning up the chain of command, or no, we're not. Go ahead.
Couldn't there be like an express lane window for this particular type of compassionate release? Now, look, what you're kind of talking about is the more frequent compassionate release where the inmate themselves is either dying.
It's the same. The way the law is right now, all compassionate release falls under extraordinary and compelling, right? Something came up. Now, whether it's a medical issue with the individual themselves, or it falls under this caregiver stuff, it's all the same. Now, you submit the cop out, the clock starts, right? And of course, today we have inmates have the electronic cop out, so they've got the date and time that they submitted it, right? The institution does a review. They have to make a decision. If the inmate doesn't provide sufficient information that justifies what they're saying, they can kick it back. And that request is now closed. It's not a matter of the warden denied it, and now you can go to the court. That's not what it says. If it was lapsed. Now, this is where there's been some misinterpretation and there's actually been some district courts that have like looked at this differently. But if the warden responds within 30 days and says, nope, you're denied, that doesn't mean you get the file to the court directly. You need to go through the process.
8, 9, 10, 11.
Yeah, 9, 10. Now, when we talk to folks and we say, I always tell people never, never sacrifice your administrative remedy rights. So you file, you get your denial. And if you think you're going to bypass and go directly to the court, and not file on time with your administrative remedy, and the court kicks it back, right? Because you didn't exhaust administrative remedy, but now your timeline, you've blown your timeline up. Guess what? You start over.
Over again.
And like I said, there is some discrepancy on if the denial happens, but the plain reading of it is the warden has 30 days to respond. And as long as the warden responds within 30 days, you get kicked over to the administrative remedy. If the warden doesn't respond within 30 days, you can go to the court. Go ahead.
We'll take this inmate. What's his name? Gallo something rather?
Robello Gallo.
Robello Gallo, whatever. Let's just say I'm Warden Cameron. I get this guy's request. Seem fairly compelling. What do? I go to the pre-sentence report to look for all these family members. All right. Some of it's substantiated, but kind of not everything is substantiated. The PSR is an insufficient document. Am I going to have my CMC or somebody who's going to investigate to make sure that this guy is telling the truth?
At that point, the responsibility is on the inmate, just like the district court did in this case. They kicked it back and said, but you can resubmit if you give us more information. So in that case, the warden can deny it.
Pending more information.
Because the person didn't provide sufficient documentation. You know, it would be beautiful if the PSR was nice and clear and showed that he had nobody. And this was it. But the minute you start introducing in the PSR, and you know as well as I do, the PSR is usually pretty good about family members. You know, it may tell you that maybe there's a brother in prison or there was a sister who died. But if people are living, they're in the PSR. That includes siblings. That includes parents are listed. Siblings are listed. Minor and adult children are listed. Let's take a situation, and we're going to watch your time. We're going to be good. Where there is an adult sibling to a minor child. The minor child is 14, but the minor child has a brother who's 22. That 22-year-old adult child is a valid caregiver option. It's incumbent on the inmate to explain why not. Now, we're going to jump to that because I do want to get to that. So in the court's decision, they do explain like their whole rationale and things they looked at, but we're going to jump to that. So here, the circuit court's position was it's not the sentencing commission, the guidelines, is not concerned with alleviating the burdens of imprisonment on the inmate, but with preventing the inmate's family member from being left without care during the inmate's incarceration. In other words, Section 1B1.13B3, that's the guideline, operates as a policy of last resort. It authorizes sentence reduction only when no other realistic caregiver option exists. So while they've opened the window up and talk about likely caregiver and realistic caregiver, they still say that this is an option of last resort. So it's incumbent on the inmate to fill in the facts. Yes.
Is there some sort of an imaginary line drawn? I mean, is this okay with a guy in a penitentiary with 100 years left? Is this guy okay with a guy in a medium with 30 years left? Is this okay?
Anybody can request a compassionate release if they fall within the standards. And nothing in the standards talks about the sentence.
Custody classification, nothing.
Custody classification. All the Bureau does. The Bureau is going to make some judgments about the individual, their offense, their criminal history, et cetera, et cetera. And if they deny it all the way, that's what administrative remedy is for. That's what going to the district court after administrative remedy they can do.
Yeah.
Ultimately, this is the court's decision. Okay, so jumping to what are they looking for? They have identified a list of five factors, different five factors They explained that they described this as, we offered the following non-exhaustive list of factors that the district court should consider in determining whether the potential caregiver is qualified and free. So, qualified to do it, free to. Okay, first, the district court should consider whether legal barriers prevent the potential caregiver from providing care. These are the other caregivers, not the inmate. These are the alternative caregivers. Is there a legal barrier? They provide examples of immigration status that could affect where they can lawfully remain in the country, where the incapacitated family member resides. May also include other legal obligations such as military enlistment. If you're, you know, so those are the examples they give. Second, the district court should consider the physical or logistical barriers to caregiving. Geographic distance may render a caregiving impractical depending on the circumstances. However, they note, we do not adopt a bright line geographical rule. Instead, fact finders should consider the feasibility and burdens of relocation, both the caregiver relocating to the relative and vice versa, in assessing whether an alternative caregiver is free to provide the necessary care. So going to the son who lived 4 hours away, there is no 500-mile rule. There is no, you know, has to be in the same time zone. There's no standard. There's no bright line geographical standard. Third, the district court should consider whether knowledge and capacity-based barriers affect caregivers' qualifications. A potential caregiver should be able, for example, to be able to speak the same language as the caregiver. My great-grandmother is obviously no longer alive, but she did speak English, right? My mother, who obviously was a first-generation American, her father, who was born in Italy, he didn't speak that much Italian either. He spoke enough, but grandma never spoke English. So in that situation, my mom, had she been adult, had we been talking about the same thing, right? She could not be a caregiver because she can't communicate. They spoke a different language. Similarly, potential a potential caregiver would need to learn specialized language. Specialized medical schools may not be qualified. Now, they do talk within here is this notion of, would a caregiver, in terms of specialized knowledge, maybe this is changing dressings for wound care, as an example, right? There is some specialized knowledge you need to learn. But an inmate who's a layperson and an alternate caregiver who's also a layperson would have to learn the same type of knowledge. So unless you can demonstrate that that person is incapable of learning that specialized knowledge, then it's not an issue. Now, hypothetically, if an inmate had a medical background, they were a doctor, a nurse, a PA, a mid-level practitioner, and their parent required some specialized care that they literally could do better than other family members because they aren't medical providers and I have this medical background, that may be an argument. But remembering that if you're a dentist specialized in dental care doesn't necessarily make you an expert for wound care for a diabetic or an amputee. So kind of keep that in mind. Like being a doctor or medical professional doesn't give you like the carte blanche, right? Okay, four, a district court should consider any familial dynamics or relationship history that may bear on an alternative caregiver's availability. So they talk about things like, were they estranged? Or was there a close relationship? Was there a pattern of abuse? You know, is this a, you know, you're not going to, an alternative caregiver, if there's a pattern of abuse by the person or they had an estranged relationship, going to the situation of caring for an elderly father, and this is, say, a sibling to an inmate. Well, if they had a falling out 15 years ago and he hasn't spoke to his father in the last 15 years, is he really available? No, not really, right? So talking about that, they talk about the example of evidence of the family member or friend has previously cared for the incapacitated person. Notice there they introduced family member or friend. Does the person have someone who has been providing care in the past or has done, maybe isn't the current caregiver, but has been a caregiver in the past for this person? They have a close relationship. So again, it's not necessarily the inmate has the immediate family requirement, right? This is their immediate family member. But the person who needs the care, it's not restricted to immediate family members. They could have a relation, like who's been taking care of them during this period of time. They're not, are they in the hospital? Are they in the nursing home? Right. Or are they at home? Who's helping them now? Right. Those are valid questions. And fifth, the district court should consider any economic, financial, or employment-related barriers that would impact the caregiver's availability. And this is important here. Although alternate caregivers may not be expected to surmount unusual or extraordinary obstacles, a caregiver is not unavailable merely because providing care would require balancing caregiving with other obligations, because that would be the same for the inmate. If they get a compassionate release and they are the primary caregiver,
they're still going to have to balance.
They're going to have to still balance the same kind of thing that someone on the street would. So again, it's demonstrating that they can't do this, and you can, right?
So 3 minutes. 3 minutes. Three.
Okay.
Three.
In the end, on this particular case, the district court affirmed the appellate court affirmed the lower court's decision, meaning the individual was not granted a compassionate release, because the circuit court, after laying out these five facts, these five kind of assessment criteria that they identified, they looked at the record of the district court and said, did the district court look at these? And they did. Did the district court make an error? No, they didn't. They covered these areas. And in their decision, the individual, the adult son, was in fact a valid option. Whether he wanted to be or not is a different subject, but the court didn't make an error. So, like I said, this was ruled in February, and the second court came up. He came to before the appeals court in April, and the court just kicked it back, remanded it back to the district court to say, hey, look at these five factors. We will put these notes, these case notes, we'll put it up on the YouTube channel, and we'll put it up on Facebook so folks can, I'll send you a link so folks can find that information. But again, this is really interesting because the court is clearly saying, now this is one court, right? This is the 11th. So that covers, I looked this up. I wrote it right down. That covers Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. I don't necessarily keep my circuit court straight, but it covers those three states. But for somebody looking to appeal in another circuit, a decision, this is what we call precedence, judicial precedence. It'll be interesting to see how this kind of plays out in other circuits. If other circuits kind of agree with the 11th, say, yep, that sounds reasonable, then, you know, we could have it won't need to go to the Supreme Court unless the government fights it. And then it'll vary from court to court. I think, you know, someone like the Ninth Circuit that tends to be pretty flexible won't have a problem with it. Other courts might. It'll be interesting. So very, very fascinating read.
Very good. In at the buzzer. Awesome. Plus, I like the fact that I think there are people that would qualify this that are really the last man or woman standing. You know, I like that. I like that aspect where it's, I would love to see somebody go into the court process and say, I am it. I am
And they don't have to be the last living, breathing person. They just have to be that available person. And
eligible caregiver. Yeah, but still, but
yeah. They're taking a more reasonable, realistic, as opposed to you're the last man standing on the planet. You know, so I think that's fantastic. It's fantastic. I know we're going to go really quick. We got the cover art draft back today for our new book coming out. It's with the editor now. So we are getting close to releasing our new Unlocking book, and this will be on the Second Chance Act. Inspired by your shirt. I was going to say we'll affectionately refer to it as the Red Book. I love the color. Yeah. I literally said, think like colonial red. Like, we don't want it fire engine red. And I think she came back with some great color. It looks great. So yeah,
it does. It does. As usual, she does a great job. Well, folks, that's a wrap. Again, once again, thanks for coming and listening in on our show today. Please come to our Facebook group, First Step Act, Early Release from Federal Prison, our YouTube channel, First Step Act YouTube channel.
Yeah, I want to see more followers on the YouTube channel.
We'll get there. I haven't been paying attention. And some other stuff's coming out I got in the wings here. So, okay, everybody. Well, have a great week. And that was a good show. And make sure you come back, because next time it's going to be just as good, if not better, with more information that you're probably not going to get anywhere else. I'm just going to tell you. All right. Have a blessed week, everybody. See you next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody. See you.
Bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.